This is like the how many, what is the total number of 7-year-olds that it would take you down? Because it's there is a number.
What kind of question is that? Like,
if you want a chinchilla, I'll get you a chinchilla.
If I want an American flag made out of the hide or the fur of something, I want it made out of an American animal. Now I'm like, what in the world was I ever afraid of? I'm going to football punt this thing. Like, I'm here for you. Like, thunk, see you later.
Would you rather fight a horse-sized duck or 100 duck-sized horses?
Are you bringing back frosted tips? Scott, is your hair lightening?
Yeah, that's actually what happens naturally with age.
Two guys telling stories and talking shop when it comes to life, work, marriage, fatherhood, and anything else that comes to mind.
This is At the Breach. I'm a natural at this, Michael.
This is At the Breach.
All right.
And looks like that's that. Just okay. Like that. Welcome, men. I will hand the ball off.
All right. Scott, allow me, sir, to introduce my good friend from back in the day, Matt Thomas. Matt Thomas, welcome to the show. Good to have you on here. Normally, the format is there is no format, and we just pick right up into a conversation that Scott, John, or myself are already involved in, which usually is like whiplash for the listener.
And then perfect. I probably won't even be able to follow it anyways.
Yeah, that's kind of the next situation normal. And I have quite a story. And this is, I just got to throw it out there. I know this is an episode about introducing you, but I got to throw it out there for a discussion for the group. All right. So last night, my wife, Monica, is out. She got invited to She got invited to a thing. She had to go. She was going with one of her girlfriends. It was cool. So it meant that I am watching the kiddos. And we have an early dinner. Got back from a soccer tournament for my oldest boy. Have an early dinner. Wife gets dressed up and goes off to her event. And it's still daytime. And so we're like, yeah, we're going to go. I was like, I gotta find something for the kids to do. Me and the boys. And Memphis is away visiting her mother this weekend. So it's just me and the boys. So I'm like, all right, we'll walk down to the tennis courts that are near our house. And we'll play some tennis or we'll goof off. And just, you know, whatever. We're finally getting everybody out of the house with water bottles and tennis rackets, you know, as though we're going to be crossing the Sahara on our way down there. But I'm an overpacker. It's left over from the military. I walk outside of my house, and this guy in a full context, there's also a sanctioned community garage sale weekend. So like there is like 50 garage sales going on in this little town that I live in over the weekend. So there's lots of foot traffic and blah, blah, blah. This guy slow rolls by me on the street in his car with his window down. He's like, hey man, there's a house fire. And then he just drives off. I'm like, what? And I turn and look, and like four houses down up the street from me is just a plume of black smoke like I've never seen. And so like, I'm like, holy crap. So I tell my boys, I yell at my boys. I have a little bit of guilt after this one. I was like, go inside, go inside and look after your brother. I'm talking to my oldest boy, and I'm, you know, my oldest boy is eight, or I'm sorry, he's nine. My oldest boy is nine. So I'm like, 9-year-old, you have the con. Take the boys inside, keep track of them, and stay inside. No questions. I was like, that was kind of the verbal cue of like, hey, dad needs compliance. Now, go inside, no questions, look after your brother. I go bombing up to this house without really thinking about it. Arrive on the scene before anybody else is there. And I'm like, oh, crap. I may have outkicked the coverage here. I was kind of hoping that I'd just be running up and there'd be like a bunch of firefighters. I'd be like, you guys good? Good. All right. Carry on. No firefighters yet. People are starting to come out of their houses and this baby's raging. I go up to the front door. Front door's locked. Smoke is billowing everywhere, coming out like the mail slot. I may have been like pumping on adrenaline, but it looked like the paint was bubbling up on the door. And I'm a veteran of the 90s movies. So I know from watching Backdraft that that's not the one you want to go in. You want to check that door for heat, Pete? And then, you know, so give it a kick, but not really. And it's like, all right, that one's not going to open. So I go around the back of the house, and the back of the house is where this, the patio is. I'm not a fire investigator, but I think that's probably where it started, because the back patio is raging. And little hat tip to the first responders out there, because I've never heard anything like the noises that this fire was making. All right. It was like, and then everything was hissing. And I was like, holy, like, I'm not like, fuck, this is wild, dude. Like, I was like, oh man, this is not good. This is scary. So I was like, well, we can't get up into the patio. There's a basement. So I go down to the basement, and I'm at this like basement door. It's a sliding glass door. And I'm like trying to open it. It's locked. I look in through the basement, and on the other side of the house is completely black smoke. So I'm like, oh man, this house is like opposite end of the house in the basement, full of smoke from where the patio is, where I'm like, okay, that's where the raging fire is. Go back around to the front, because I was like, I can't get in there. And I was like, if I go into the basement, that might be a wrap based on how smoky it is. Go back around to the front. I'm going up to the front door, and a neighbor comes up, and she's like, hey, I'm on the phone with the homeowner. There's nobody inside. I was like, whew, thank goodness, because we don't want to go inside. Next door neighbor's house, I'm like, is anybody home here? Because they have it's only like 6 feet or maybe a little bit more from like the house that's next door. And I was like, this is going to like jump houses and get going here. So I run into that person's backyard. They have an automatic sprinkler hose hooked up to something. I was like, well, that's not going to help me. So I unhook their automatic sprinkler system, hook up a new hose. And then this other guy that was like, he's like probably 18 or something like this, running around with me. He's like following me. I was like, dude, grab the other hose or grab the end of the hose and start spraying down this fence. And like, so nothing can jump over onto this thing. So we sat there and, you know, did a little fence protection for the neighbor and kind of sprayed a little bit on the house. And then the fire department showed up finally. And I went out there and was like, all right, everything's locked up. Nobody's in the house. Pretty crazy. But, ended up being like two firehouses respond to this. There were two battalion chief trucks out there, a fire investigator, like Tacoma Fire sent like two ladder trucks, like three engines. It was wild, dude. Wild. Yeah. So, yeah. But anyways, hat tip to the first responders. If you're a firefighter listening to this and you hear the sounds that fires can make, and yet you still go in the house, my hat's off to you. Pretty wild.
The correct terminology would be two alarm fire.
Two alarm fire. Yeah. So it was a two alarm fire. It was a big deal. It was a big deal.
That's what I appreciate about John. He's like young Jamie, but more like, more like in there. You know what I mean? He's more like knowledgeable, I feel.
I did come back after my brief stint as a volunteer local moron. My oldest boy was not pleased with me. He was pretty upset because they couldn't really see what was going on. They just saw me get upset. And I was like, hey, go in the house. Go in the house now. No questions. Look after your brothers. I come back and he was like, dude, that ain't cool.
It's very Mel Gibson and the Patriot of you.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is like... If my children were of that age and that were to occur, I know that my boys would not listen to me and immediately get involved in that war. Anyways. Oh, yeah.
That's hat tip to you as well, though, Mike. I
mean, lore. Mean,
that's a hat tip to you.
The legend of Mike the Neighbor
continues
to grow, because one of my neighbors was who has known my wife and I for some time before we even moved into this neighborhood. We were actually pumped. We're like, oh, we're like three houses down from you. She was able to see from her backyard this house fire and sees me running into this situation. And she came up afterwards and she was like, you are in trouble. I am going to tell Monica. Yeah. It was wild. It was good.
You're probably on some YouTube videos from people's phones recording you. Like, yeah, look at this. Dude.
Look at this dingus.
Look at this dingus.
But yeah, I like, and was like my clothes stink of fire. My clothes smell bad. The whole neighborhood is all out of whack. But I mean,
was there any, so this happened in our neighborhood not long ago. I don't know, probably 3 years ago at this point. We were watching a movie. You know, it's dark. We're in our TV, you know, like room. And there's a loud explosion.
Ooh.
And I'm like, that didn't sound good. And I walk out the front door and there's clearly a house ablaze, like around the corner from our house. Did you hear any of that stuff or was it just on fire?
Like I said, I didn't even know anything because I was facing the other direction until the guy slow rolled by me in the car and was like, you know, the village.
Hey, house is on fire.
Village crier. The village crier drove by. Dude, house fire. And then immediately drove away to go warn more people that the British were coming or something. I don't know what he was doing, but he was like, all right, there's a house fire, but I'm out of here. Yeah. And at this point in time, fortunately, and you guys could tell me if this is a egotistical issue. Nobody was hurt. Nobody was in there. No pets, no nothing. Like it's still tragic, right? Like somebody's house burned. And I think that's probably going to be a total loss. But nobody was hurt. There was no loss of life. I was like, oh man, I didn't get a save. I didn't get a pull. I didn't like get anything out of this. If there's another house fire in which I am able to do this now, it's like, hey man, twice you're setting these and you're creating an environment in which this is happening. So there it is. But
the potential was there though.
Yeah. The spirit was willing. The spirit was willing.
I would say you set the example for the neighborhood as well of like, hey.
Yeah. It was something.
You could be the help before the help comes.
Right. You know? I gave a brief. This Faircrest police officer rolled up. He was the first dude who made it there. As far as official capacity, I come out and he's kind of like chattering into his radio, which makes sense. But I'm like, hey, dude, front door and the back door are locked. Neighbors report that nobody's inside. Nobody's home at this house either. You know, I'm giving him my handoff. And he just sort of like kind of stared at me like, I was like, all right, well, the pros are here. I'm going to go play tennis with my boys. See you later. And then we went. Yeah.
I think those little tidbits, though, will definitely help. Such a speeds up their reaction time.
Well, I mean, basically doing the calculus that I did, I was like, there's nobody inside. So set up a perimeter and keep it contained, I guess. I don't know.
Here's battlefield handoff. And I'm out.
Yeah,
like, I set the conditions.
Here's my 9-line. Appreciate your service. I'm going to go play tennis, which devolved into tennis baseball down at the tennis courts.
Yeah.
Having said that, hey, Matt, welcome.
What an adventure.
I know, right?
And that's just a typical, Friday night, Saturday night?
That was Saturday. Just a typical Saturday.
Yeah, just hanging out.
Sounds like Tacoma.
Yeah, and here's the other aspect of it. Monica mistakenly took both sets of car keys because they like we were swapping cars back and forth yesterday. So yeah. She had both sets of car keys in her little clutch purse thing. So I couldn't drive the truck down to the tennis court. So we were walking. If that hadn't have happened, I would have been in the truck and I probably would have been like, well, we're out of here. And then drive by and then told somebody, hey, there's a house fire. And then drove on. But because I was on foot, we had to respond.
Oh, early warning is key.
Yeah. Yeah. So
you did what you could.
I apologize, but welcome to how we roll on At the Breach. We just let it fly. Matt, welcome.
Tell
us a little bit about yourself. Tell us a little bit about how you and I, where's our overlap? And then kind of give us from the beginning, in the beginning.
Oh, in the beginning, a long, long time ago, not too long. Let's see. I'm Matt Thomas. Thank you for putting me on the show. I appreciate you guys, Scott and Mike. I'm currently here in Newport, Washington. So I'm tucked away in the mountains up here, over on the border of Idaho. So most people think of Washington, where you're at in Tacoma, as like the temperate rainforest. I'm a little bit more of the Mediterranean temperate area close to the Idaho border and Canada, which is a little bit of a different terrain and I think a different type of lifestyle. Did not originate from this area. More of an army brat, moved across from Europe in the States. Never really had a place where you'd really call home before until now, when I recently retired from the army, where the overlap with Mike begins. How long ago was that? Was that like 10? Gosh, I don't even remember when we first met at regiment. That was a while ago. Retired 20 years at the Army. Spent most of my time down there in Tacoma at JBLM. I think we crossed paths occasionally in different rifle companies. We did a couple of staff nerd jobs up in the shop, nugging away. And after that, you reached out to me and to come onto this show to, I think, talk about kind of how I ended up here in this area.
Yeah, and I don't want to steal thunder. So let's don't divulge just the whole setup just yet. Tell me a little bit about the where in Europe. I didn't know you came from Europe. Was that when you were, I guess, living the army brat lifestyle?
Yeah, I live in the army brat lifestyle. So I spent some time in Germany, but I was way young back nice. Then. And then I did some time in, lived in Norway for a little bit as well, which is an awesome, beautiful area. If you've never been,
I have never
spent a couple years there, and then moved back to the States with my father. He also retired Army as well.
That's cool. Do you remember much of that time, like as a kid, having grown up like in Europe?
A little bit when I was in Norway. It was definitely a kind of middle school years. Beautiful time, beautiful area. I enjoy just remembering the mountains and the fjords and the oceans. And
right.
I mean, different culture, different food. But I think that the difference is when I spent a lot of time in Europe when I was younger, then I moved back to the States when I got older for like high school time frame. And then, you know, moved on and joined the army right after high school. It's kind of a different perspective, I guess, from, you know, people who grew up in the States their entire lives. You know, you kind of saw two different kind of cultures. When I was going to school in Europe, it was more of an international school. So I got to see.
Oh, cool.
Unbeknownst to me, you know, different cultures, different languages, you know, different lifestyles, stuff like that. And I got to grow up with that kind of perspective. And then I came to the States, and that was also a different kind of, I would say, a culture shock, really, for me, because it was a very different lifestyle and culture. You go to international school in Europe, then you go to a high school, you know, public high school, and at that time was in Las Vegas. At the time, it's like, whoa, okay, there's a different, very different dynamic going on there. Not many casinos and, you know, all the other sorts of stuff happened in, you know, in Norway when you go over to Vegas. So it was very interesting seeing those two different perspectives and lifestyles that kind of had to adapt to those changing environments.
I'll remember it like vividly. It'll be kind of one of those stories that goes on for like, you know, our entire family history, I think, is as my daughter was learning English, she was also learning Italian. Just being like in a school on the economy, you know, local Italian, they call them an asilo, which is like a preschool kind of thing. So as she's learning colors, you know, like our kids, you know, learn colors, you know, when they're at that age, and yellow and giallo. And she's like talking to me with an Italian tonal inflection, which is kind of symphatic, you know, it's, you know, da 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 da, you know, like it's a me, a Mario, you know, that there's a reason why that exists, right? And you know, she's like, Daddy, the house is giallo. And it's like, well, I couldn't figure out like for the life of me what she was trying to say. And I was like, oh, she's saying the house is yellow, you know, because my Italian was broken up at the time and everything else. So it's just kind of cool to hear, you know, your kind of viewpoint on that. And my daughter, who is 17, who is, you know, like, oh, I need an interesting fact about myself for this icebreaker, you know, going to business school. I'm like, you lived in Italy for like the first 5 years of your life. Like, you know what? She's like, I mean, is that really interesting? I'm like, yeah, dude, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I find that pretty cool. Just the exposure to the different cultures and everything else. That's neat to know that you still kind of take that with you, and hopefully she will too, you know, when she's a little bit.
Yeah, older. Absolutely.
I probably speak about her too much nowadays, but it's a kind of the nature of things, I guess.
Matt, did you appreciate it or did you not like it? Like I obviously you appreciate it now.
Sure. Yeah.
Did you not like it then when you were going through it?
No, that's a great question. And when I was there in the moment, I obviously don't appreciate it as much as I do now, because I think that kind of set a good foundation of just kind of who I am, those early life experiences. But in the moment there now, it's kind of like, no, like I'm in Norway. Okay, I'm in Norway. Like it doesn't really mean much. It's like, okay, right. This is just where I live. It's where I go to school. These are the friends I have. That I know it was so different from the way other people live in the States or a typical American kid's life. I didn't realize that at the time. Really, not until like maybe even after high school. Oh, wow, that was completely different than how most people live. So I didn't really appreciate that fact of how much it kind of broadened my horizon.
Nice. Fair enough.
Yeah.
When you joined the Army, like you said, right after high school, was that also something that you were seeking, or did you like join the Army immediately with a Ranger contract? And
no, so yeah, kind of that pathway there. Growing up as a kid, you know, and you see your father, career military person, you kind of always kind of had that in. Oh yeah, soldier, Army, the military. And as I got older, that kind of fell away. And it's not something I was really pursuing at the time. But, you know, the teenage, high school years, like, okay, other stuff going on. And then, like, everybody remembers when 9/11 happens, they know exactly what they were doing. Like, I was in class when that happened, and the teachers bring in TV screens and shut down all teaching. You just watch what's going on the screen. The planes hitting the Twin Towers. You're like, oh, you know, go through all that. And you're like, man, that kind of hits differently. And then you start seeing all of your friends wanting to join up. And then later on, you start seeing other wars in Iraq and everything else going on. It escalates. And then people are graduating high school that you better join the military. And that kind of, that interest came back as well with more of a, like all young men, you know, that pool to sort of, you know, protect family, protect country, everything else that goes with this decision. So really, shortly after high school, I was kind of at that point of like seeing how the war escalated, everything that happened, where everybody I knew was going. I was right there with it. I was on board. Did not join with the Ranger contract immediately. I was more of an airborne contract guy, one of those that was in basic training where they were like, anybody want to go to RIT? You know, I was like, sure, I'll go to RIT. Well, now you have to go do this PT test or whatever to prove that you guys should get a RIT contract. I was one of those knuckleheads that smoked myself and pushed through it, and eventually they just sent me off to RIT after that one.
God, man. Were you like other than the connection of your father that sort of whether you realize it or not, like you say, you're like, I wasn't interested in that when I was in high school, but then you ended up there. As far as military service goes, were you like big into sports? Any other early indicators of like, oh yeah, that fits? Or was it just completely one of those things? Cause I remember you being, you know, at 275, just being like, oh yeah, Thomas. And for those of us those that have, two first names, a first name for a first name and a first name for a last name.
Yes.
End up having the, you know, everybody's just called by their last name, Thomas. Last or name. Whatever
exactly.
So,
you know, no. Okay. Sure.
But yeah, did you have any other early signs of like, oh yeah, that fits? Like, organized sports, you know, aggressive organized activities. Sports. Yeah.
Which is funny because most people who are the typical, you know, Ranger contract regiment guy or, you know, anybody that's going to the SOF or doing anything like that, the typical is like, this is an athlete, you know, he did all these team sports, which is like, okay, that's kind of the trend. I was kind of the opposite. I did probably track and field was the only sport that I really did. That was more like middle school. High school, I had no interest in sports, no organized teams, no extracurricular activities. I barely graduated. I was the skater kid, up to no good. You know, escaping and evading.
I would argue that fits
certain trends as well. What was that
psych study, that anecdotal psych study that came out when RASP was really starting to get going? They were like, we better start to unravel the mind of these morons. They were like coming up with weird studies, or like, the only thing that separates them from criminals is a high, like, I can't remember, it was like some sort of like reverence for authority or something along these lines. I don't know what it was, but it was really, it was like, oh man, a lot of commonality between these guys and potentially ne'er-do-wells. What's the only marker that's different? Like, I don't know.
That kind of tracks in my case. Like,
that's
where I was. So yeah, maybe there's a, I'd never heard this study before, but yeah, I mean, only a few degrees of separation between criminal behavior and warfighter. Yeah.
And it's I'll take it. I want to say that it was something along the lines of like a high level of, or trying to be a protector. It was like the only thing, like willing to go hard in the paint, air quotes, as long as you're protecting. Whereas without that protecting, whatever that was, and I don't know the psychological term for it, you're just willing to go hard in the paint to get what you want. That's usually like, career criminal. Yeah, like
my computer blew up.
I think
your computer's
down.
Done, dude.
It's alternate comms.
There's no more limping.
Seriously.
But the good news is we have technology. We are reconnected. So I will hand it off to y'all. You are in the midst of your transition.
Okay. Perfect.
Okay.
Sorry about that, guys.
So
let me ask you about transit. So were you a seated first sergeant when you were retiring out?
I was not. I was a master sergeant. Never put the diamond in the middle of the top three and down there.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Of the end of the inning, as it were.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool too then. So you also said that you were able to actually take that 12 months out time period, which I think a lot of dudes, like, you know, guys, whatever, they're like, oh man, I can't come out of seat. You know, I can't take a whole year out, and sometimes it's not supported by command. How was that portion of it for you? Did you have to prioritize yourself and your transition when you were getting out, or did you have support from the command? Like, how could you tell me a little bit more about that scenario?
Yes.
That 12-month out window thing.
Now, when I say 12 months out, I was out of the seat 12 months out. What it was, though, it was, I was definitely afforded as much time as I needed between the work I had going on in the office and then what I wanted to do. The command was very amenable to it, which was awesome. They were very supportive, whatever it was, medical, going to job fairs, going to transition services, whatever I needed, they were very amenable to it. About 6 months out, I did get to kind of transition out with my counterpart, get them trained up, take over, and I was pretty much on my own after that to really get settled in for getting out at that point. So it was good from that perspective of command to the transition member or the person that's getting out was very good. And a lot of time to think and make the decisions, which can be good and bad because your thinking dynamic goes back and forth of like, where do I want to live? What do I want to do? How do I want to shape my life? Where do I want my family to go? A plethora of decisions that, I mean, veterans have to go through, especially when they spend an entire career, you know, in the military.
So what do you feel? Okay, so obviously the command was supportive. That speaks to their ability to be so, right? I don't feel that a command, generally speaking, is like, no, F that guy. You know, he's getting out of the army. We're not going to let him do the things to safeguard his family and protect himself for when he gets out. Because command, as a general, you know, statement, kind of, I mean, you spend your whole career taking care of soldiers, and taking care of soldiers is, you know, one of those things of, okay, well, he needs 12 months to transition out or whatever. How do you feel that you, as the transitioning soldier, you know, getting out of the army, what was your active role in that? You know, like, were you just over communicative with your command? Were you like, what kind of positive things did you have to do from your end in order to facilitate their support of you?
Mm-hmm. No, great question. Definitely the over communication, like right off the get go up front, like, I want to retire. This is the date I want to retire. Here's my backwards plan off of that. Kind of where I think I can handle the workload still, where I'm going to need somebody to then backfill me so they can plan personnel management from there. What I would like to do from whatever transition services or skill bridge or anything like that, when I would like to do that, and, you know, timing after that, because I don't want to leave a gap in workload as well for them. So as much as I can help them with the decision making up front so they don't have to turn their wheels because they have a lot of other things going on as well, I think kind of makes that easier decision making for everybody, really, because it really lays my path out as well in that last critical year. So over communication is key in planning it out.
Yeah, and I think that kind of goes, one of those things that isn't really addressed, right? Like, you know, we go through the Soldier for Life Transition Assistance Program, and we go through all these different cohorts and things along those lines. And I know that I have heard, and granted, this was when I was going through that whole process, you know, over 5 years ago at this point, you know, oh, my command screwed me, or, you know, oh, you know, I had this issue and I had that issue. It's like, well, I don't know, man. Like,
I would wonder if it's the, you know, the trope, the recruiter fucked me.
Right.
Yeah. Like, or yeah, really?
You didn't do your diligence. Right.
I mean, come on now. Like, yeah. I remember really kind of not dictating the show, but I was like, nah, this is what I'm interested in. This is what I would like to do when I was dealing with my recruiter. And mm-hmm. he was like, okay, you sure? He's like, we got other options. I was like, no, I want to do this. He's like, okay. Like, you know, I don't remember anybody being like, well, yeah, what you need to do is this, meh, 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 and, you know, right, which is the trope that I always heard from people, like, ah, the recruiter got me. I didn't know that I could get a bonus. Like, you're just being a weirdo. Yeah.
You have to take
over. It's almost the same thing. It's like a parallel. It's like, oh, my command screwed me. Now, having said that, there were certain instances in which it was like, hey, dude, like, do you, like, if you can't, from the perspective of command, if there's a training exercise or there's some rotation that you're going to do, like a CTC rotation out to, you know, and it's like, I can't make it happen without this sunsetting NCO. It's like, really? If you can't make it happen without that guy, like, there's a bigger problem than him trying to do a transition or her trying to do a transition program. You've set up a single point of failure that without that person, your unit fails, then that's a problem with your unit, not the guy.
One of the things that we would run into was, and this is, you know, I did everything short of, you know, jumping on somebody's desk and clearing it, you know, and all the theatrics that you see in the movies or whatever. But, hey, we need to bring soldier XYZ to this, you know, CTC rotation, this major training rotation. It's like, why? You know, like, they're getting out, they're on profile, they're of very little value,
right,
to the mission. We can take care of them better by leaving them here or something along those lines. And then I just, that was one less case of MREs I had to account for.
Right.
You know, like, that was just one less mouth I had to feed. Just leave him in the back, like, leave him or her in the back, and just, like, don't let it be a parasitic leech on our resources and our assets. Oh, no, we have to get the numbers up.
Yeah, sure.
All right, man. I mean, I get it, but, like, this person's out in 6 months anyway, and they're going to obscure your numbers. Like, you're not, I will never claim to have been smarter than anybody that I was ever, you know, worked for or anything like that. It's just some of those numbers games get a little dicey. I was taken care of just fine as I was retiring and setting out. But, and I'm really happy that you said what you said, Matt, because it was the same way that I was like, hey, look, I've got a cohort that starts here. I've got this program that starts here. I've got job interviews here. You know, this is my plan. If you can support it, or if we need to edit it or make alterations, then let me know where we do that. And mm-hmm. you know, we'll, because there's also regulatory things that you have sure. to hit, regulatory benchmarks that you have to hit. Right. So yeah, I'm really happy to hear you say that, because I think that the three of us all were able to retire in a way that was conducive to our success, because we also took the ownership and we had the, mm-hmm. the self accountability of that program. And I think that sometimes that may get lost on a few people who don't take that time. I had a brigade command sergeant major that was signing out in 30 days and he was going to his first meeting that you're supposed to have done 12 months out. And it's like, I mean, hey man, I get it. Like, you're a busy dude, but like, you also have a family, like, you know, yeah. you have like a whole bunch of stuff to get in order here, you know? Mm-hmm. So, a good dude, and he ended up being fine. I ran into him 18 years later or 18 months later. He was competing at the Highland Games locally. Cool. Well, he was yoked too, man. He was like, this guy was huge. Like,
the caber toss is a fascinating event.
Yeah. He actually won the caber toss, and he had this beard down to his belly. He still had a screaming forefinger high and tight, but beard down to his belly. Yeah, it was wild. Anyway, sorry, completely getting off track. But
he did it right.
Yeah. So, right. So Matt, I gotta know, and this is kind of gives you an opportunity to divulge what it is that you're doing, because this is also really fascinating. So, from what you started to as a potential option that you were exploring getting out through your transition processes, mm-hmm. going to job fairs and such, and then transitioning to what you are actually doing now, mm-hmm. was there, you know, why don't we start there? What are you doing now?
What I'm doing now is I am stewarding a 10-acre piece of land. Let me give you some context here, because some people are going to be like, you're doing what? this is a mix. I already told you guys where I'm at up in Newport, Washington. So I'm in northeastern Washington right now. And this is the first time I'm owning 10 acres of land, which is a mix of forest, wetland, mountainous terrain. And to some people that might be like, okay, cool. So what? In that, I have a little homestead house. I'm not off grid, so don't think like, oh, he's off grid. I'm not off grid, okay? But that being said, I'm in that location, in this environment, with this terrain. And this comes back to the decision-making of when you're getting out of, like, what do you want to do with your life? And this is where it kind of got dicey on how I ended up here with my family of, this was not my original idea. I did not think I was going to be a semi-retired veteran with my family up in the mountains trying to take care of this piece of land. That was not the original goal. And I'll back up even further than that and wrap it up real quick. The original goal was I was actually going to stay in northeastern United States is where I was going to be. And everything, all the decisions based off of, and I think this is critical for everybody else that's getting out, or not even veterans, anybody, career transition, wherever you're going to be, it's going to be place-based, because all of your options are in the environment where you're physically located. And I know remote work can be fully remote, but that also limits your options of what you're actually doing, which is, I think, plays more into like computer stuff, cyber stuff and all that, which I'm not a cyber wizard, as you guys already know with my technology that I have. So that being said, we were originally thinking, we were already in Maryland at the time when I was getting out. We like the area that we're at in Annapolis, beautiful environment by the ocean, green, it's forest, it's beautiful. But we didn't want to stay in Maryland. So, okay, well, we want to kind of stay in this area. What are other options that fit our location requirements? And me and my wife are kind of the same way of like, hey, we like mountains, we like green, we want forests, we like to be outside, we like the outdoors. Well, we have Northern Virginia, beautiful. You have Western Virginia, beautiful. You have, I mean, North Carolina. We were even looking at parts of Texas, believe it or not, just because of, you also have to think of like veteran benefits, cost of living. Are we want a piece of land? You want a house? What do you, if you want land, what do you even want to do with it? You know, these are all the options of like, okay, and how much is that going to cost? What can you afford? So we're looking at Northeast Washington because also there's a lot of big job market. You have the, you have DC, big tech companies, defense tech, DOD type stuff. You have a ton of stuff that plays that's good for the veteran and somewhat good veteran benefits as well. So I was looking more at more of the emergency management realm. I got certified in business continuity because all of my prior military experience certified me for that civilian certification. And I was really going heavy on targeting that industry and that location, northeastern kind of states, looking at business continuity, working in that realm because, you know, you peel the onion some more. I think all veterans are a little bit idealistic, a little altruistic. I kind of want to stay into that realm of like, I'm already, what's the average lifespan of males in America? You know, now at 70, you know, yeah. We're already halfway there, brother. You know, you're yeah. going, what do you want to do with the last half? You know? So I still want to contribute. There's still part of me that I have that drive. Like I want to contribute. Like we brought up in the very beginning of this podcast, like Mike, you said veterans want to, they want to protect. There's a part of you that wants to contribute and do something like that. Okay. So I was leaning towards emergency management and business continuity at that time. But looking at the places that we could live the way we want to live, that decision or that framework kind of changed. Before of thinking of like, we want just a small piece of land, nice house, get a good job, easy transition. Job market's huge there. It kind of evolved as we got closer to leaving. Like, do you really want to be on call 24/7? Do you want to, you know, work the 9-to-5? Do you want that traffic? Do you want all those other things that come into play? You know, when you think of that area, that place-based kind of thinking, it's like, well, what do you really want? Well, we actually want more land because we actually want to grow our own food. Because we care about food for our children, for ourselves, just financially, it makes sense for the long run if you can support that. Also, from a, we talked about continuity of operations here at the tech. Think about the food supply chain. We already saw that in COVID. You see that in trade wars. You see it all over. So, more for security for me and my family was, let's grow some of our own food. Well, we need some land if we're going to do that. So those areas did not fit our framework we were looking at. So we need to move from there. And I focused heavily on that. So now you have to pivot. Decision changed. The way we want to live changed. Well, where are we going to apply where we want to go now? We looked at other locations. We ended up back here in northeastern Washington, kind of fit budget, terrain, lifestyle, how we want our children to grow up. That all changed and ended up here. What dropped off was job market. You completely changed the job market on this location. So which also changes, well, let's talk finances now. All right, which everybody that transitions or pivots to different careers, you have to put that in your framework of like, what can you afford? And we ended up specifically designing the way we're living right now based off of our budget to be able to not that be it won't be an issue. We didn't go outside of our means, yet still fit kind of the mold that we wanted. It's not 100% our lifestyle of what we wanted, but it's very, very, very close and doable without being super concerned of like, I need a job. I need to work 9-to-5. I need to do all this. It's like, no, we specifically dropped some things off of our wish list so we could fit our priorities of what we really wanted to do and how we wanted our lives to be. Which brings me here, this 10-acre property. It's not going to manage itself because you have to think of risks as well. This is wildfire country. Wildfire is a huge risk here. I'm surrounded by forests. You have to manage it. We have 10 acres of property, I said here. I would say about 2 acres, maybe 3, are going to be starting to be put into production. that takes labor and effort as well. So you have forest that needs to be managed. You have land that needs to be managed to produce food. You have a household that's not the it's not the most brand new. It is built in the 1960s. So you also have home repairs, everything else has to go with it. And you have to have four feral children at home now that run around the mountains. So somebody has to raise human beings as well. Good humans, being husband, everything else. So you balance all of those things that you have here. That's kind of when you say, what do? That's what I do. And it's long, hard work sometimes. And sometimes it's, I walk outside and I'm like, I was telling my wife this the other day. I walk outside on my property. I'm like, I used to drive like literally 3 hours to get the feeling I do just walking in my backyard.
Yeah. Yeah. Right on, dude. The, you know, and I want to dig in a little bit on how you are preparing the land to be able to produce the, you know, to be able to
yes.
produce food. But before we do that, I really want to double down and kind of dig into the, have you always been a deliberate, intentional person with, you know, your wife and yourself talking about asking yourselves the right questions and getting to the root of what you wanted so that those of what you want in can direct the decisions you make about where you go and the jobs you're going to try to do or whatever it is. Have you always been that way or, and then how did you make sure that you were still and quiet enough to ask those questions and get those answers?
That is a excellent question. And have I always been that way? No. Especially with my spouse, I try to convey and, you know, get that introspection, really dig deep and get that root, you know, of like, what do you want in life? How are these decisions going to be made? I try to plan it out and I'm not super like risk averse, but I do like to make a deliberate decision making and we're going to do something. And transitioning out of the military is a risky move. So I think some of the transition programs and the coaches and all that definitely helped with that, to ask the right questions. Did you think about this? Because I never thought about it. I've been in the military my whole adult life. And I didn't think about that. So that really helped me of like, hey, where do you want to live? What do you want to do? Balance that off your finances. Who is going to be doing what around your home? Just domestic lifestyle. Is that okay? And then absolutely incorporate all of these conversations with your spouse, which I think is something I tried to do, but I think you definitely still need to double, triple down, make sure it's very clear. Cause, I have selective hearing is what my wife yeah. says. Sometimes I hear mm-hmm. stuff. I don't know. That's what I thought was said, but maybe
I blame it on all the blame it all on the, oh, it's too many door it's charges, too many, babe. Yeah. Sorry. Too many door charges. Couldn't hear. Sorry.
Cause that could, we talk about veterans transitioning and all that, which is a big deal and a lot of decisions have to be made. But if you're married with family too, and your spouse is right there, I mean, that's another, my spouse is transitioning too. And we're still, there's a lot of other things that are peeled behind that marriage dynamic of like, yeah, they're transitioning. We give kudos to the wives always. You give the speech at your retirement. I don't think people truly appreciate that. And sometimes I even forget and I'm like, ooh, shame on me. You know, I should have really focused in more on that because there's definitely a lot of scar tissue behind there when you get out and yeah. I don't think people realize that, but once you get to settle down you really take that time to pause. Like we're right now, this past year I've been out for a year now, this is like a huge like life pause, take the scar tissue out, let's get in it, you know, because she dealt with, you know, deployments, training cycles, everything that goes in that you forget about when you're the veteran. Or you don't forget, but you're like, okay, I acknowledge, but I have stuff to do.
Right.
You got this. So that is, this type of lifestyle really provided that opportunity to dig in and flesh some stuff out that I think is really good to just the marriage dynamic, building that family back, because you're no longer a military family. Like, this is your family. Like, this is your family. And like, for me, this is my first time I've had a piece of property and land that's like, this is mine. It's not just mine, it's my wife's and it's my kids. So it's kind of more of a special touch to it. You have more care into everything that you do with it, because you know it's not just for you, it's for your kids, it's for your kids' kids, if you do it right. And so that was kind of our main focus there. And it's definitely gives more deeper meaning in kind of your decisions. Like, these are real life decisions that you're making, which I highly encourage everybody to kind of take a pause, think about it.
Yeah.
Don't just do the grind.
The acknowledgement of your wife transitioning out as well, yeah, I think is something that's really special, really beautiful thing to capture there, man. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that's really quite.
It's huge.
Yeah.
It's huge.
I think that it's also important to kind of encapsulate that in the conversation too, right? So the only time that the spouse is encouraged is like during to attend the briefings on where I transitioned out of it at Fort Campbell anyway, was like for the life insurance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, I mean, there's so much more that goes into this, you know, like why aren't we all kind of sitting next to each other in these conversations? And, you know, why isn't this all this long process together? And I guess, you know, you can probably just take somebody with you and into those things, because at that point you're getting out anyway. So it's kind of like, you know, what are you going to do? Tell me no. You know, okay, cool. But it's important, I think, to understand that, especially after 21 years, you know, imagine you married your high school sweetheart, you know, and 20 years later, you're still married. Like, you effectively have become humans, you know, human adults together through all these, you know, turbulent, you know, traumatic experiences that when one spouse experiences, the other does too, just in a different aspect of it, right?
Yeah,
that's an enormous observation to make, and hat tip to you for actually, however you got to that conclusion, or however you got to that decision, because it could have been like, you know, something that you came up with in your own wisdom, or it could have been something where your wife was like, "Hey, buddy, I also need," you know, right. Because we know how these conversations work sometimes. But yeah, that's highly commendable for both you and your wife. To have gone through that together and kind of possess that wisdom together as a team and as a couple. So I really can't commend you enough on that. So well done.
I appreciate that. And it was definitely not a smooth kind of like, we know exactly what we're doing. This is the things that are going to happen. It was definitely, like I said before, pain and repetition. There is a lot of bumpy turns and speed bumps we hit, and I think you have to stop and acknowledge it and talk about it. If you just keep driving and keep going, you're gonna wear it out. And
speaking on the topic of like communication with your spouse, this also had to have been her want or like some. She's not just like, oh yeah, okay, cool. I guess, yeah, I guess I want this too. Like, she must want this too. And are you guys homeschooling also in all of this, or?
So our kids do go to public school here.
Okay.
And they have an awesome public school here, which is one of the decision-making things you have to think about too. If you have kids, like, you want a good school as well. So that also goes with your place-based thinking. But for her, it was definitely started off as no. In the very beginning. And then as we start talking and seeing things and really think about what we wanted and how our life and our kids need to grow up, we slowly started with her too. Is like, you know what? She told me one day, because before I was like, I want 100 acres. Yep. Let's do it. Let's throw it all in there. You know, I'll take it all. But she was like, no. Let's not do that. Because another thing, and I think you know this about me, Mike, I'm introverted at heart. I don't need a huge social butterfly network. I don't need it. Like, I'm going to go take a nap after we're done with this. But she's a little bit more social, so she's like, oh, we're going to go rural in the mountains. I need that social, you know, companionship and all that stuff. So we had to think about that as well. But then, it, like I said before, decisions change and start thinking, it's like, you know what, do I really need that much? Can I make it work? I want more land for XYZ. She started going back to priorities. What are the priorities here? We want food. If we want food, we need land. If we need land, it needs to be more rural. That's just how it works. And if we want this type of land and this doing what we need to do, it needs to fit within our budget. That way we're, you know, secure financially to make these decisions and live the way we want to live. So she slowly but surely kind of was able to prioritize herself with those decisions, which ended up aligning with my goals as well. That being said, when we're out there chopping wood, cutting down, you know, doing forestry management and all these 100 million projects we have here, building this homestead out to meet our lifestyle, sometimes she's looking at me like, what did we do? You know, I'm smoked. Which is true. I'm smoked too. I think I went through like 10 pairs of like work gloves in like a year. I'm like, I didn't even do this in the military. Like,
right,
gloves
right.
at least lasted deployment, you know?
Yeah.
But when you're out there and you see your wife pick up a freaking tree trunk to go chop it with a chainsaw in the middle of the woods, you're like, damn, girl. That's why I married this woman.
Hell yeah.
She's just living that frontier life, man. And I'm like, this is it. And, you know, sometimes she's like, you know what? This is it. Like, hell yeah. Getting after it.
Matt, my it's funny that you had said this, because one of my goals, and the reason why we stayed where we stayed, was, you know, high school age daughter, you know, creating that continuity and let her graduate and get off to college, and then, you know, we'll go from there. Anecdotally, or just out of the pocket, I'm like, yeah, 100 acres East Tennessee,
yeah,
you know, like, I don't need, you know, good observation fields of fire, but I do need some standoff, you know, mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, it's mm-hmm. it's not like, it's not kooky veteran stuff, or, you know, I mean, maybe to a certain extent, but not trying to reenact Ruby Ridge or anything like that either, but sorry, that may be a bad reference. But like, I'm right there with you, and I really appreciate the fact that you just said 100 acres and you're on 10, you know.
Yeah. Like,
That's probably the reality check that I needed, because just of who I am. I have started my own project, trying to learn, like, myself, like, how to, you know, grow my own food. And I'm still in middle-class suburbia, right? So mm-hmm. it's everything that I have in my backyard is, you know, different than, obviously, than what you're doing. It's on a much smaller scale. So the same but different, I guess, I hope. I've really worked hard in order to make sure to know that every tomato that I'm plucking is, you know, it's truly organic. It's not like organic we see in the stores, because we understand too that's a misguided label a lot of times, even all the way down to my dirt, where my dirt's never touched. A chemical has never touched the dirt that my vegetables are growing in. Mm. It's truly biodynamic. Even herbicides and pesticides, never. I'll incorporate insects to kill insects.
Mm-hmm.
I by killing weeds, it's simply by me pulling them. You know, there's never mm-hmm. chemical intervention on any of this stuff. I appreciate the idea of what you said about growing your own food and knowing where it came from. What sort of diet are you following? That kind of, you know, interjected this mentality, and, you know, are you still eating meat? Or, you know, you said you're not off grid. Are you, you know, store buying meat, or are you harvesting, you know, proteins, you know, protein sources from your own land as well? Or is it, you know, I think back to like how I first got interested in diet and nutrition, was thinking like of primal man. And we always say the paleo diet or something mm-hmm. along those lines, but it's really not paleo diet, right?
Because right.
coconut oil didn't exist for cavemen, but cooking with animal fats did, you know.
Absolutely. Like,
you know, tallow and then just rendered meat, and, you know, rendered fat from mm-hmm. everything else. And also cooking is something that I'm also very into. So I'm kind of curious as to your approach when you start thinking of nutrition or that aspect of growing your own food, living on 10 acres, you know, and kind of taking it back to, really the roots of what food is supposed to be in food sensitivity or, understanding the structure of food and how you get it. What sort of food are you growing? What are you thinking about while you're doing it? Like, are you following a certain diet or is it just a kind of a heritage diet of, you know, meats and vegetables? Like what's kind of going on there? Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll first caveat with the why of why do you want to grow your own food, which I think a lot of people have a hard time thinking about because, I mean, you have a grocery store right there, right? With all the food that you have there. And as I was transitioning out, I was looking at emergency management, looking at what's going on in the world. We have a ton of, you know, disasters and crises you can look at every day. There's something, right? Doom scrolling. Well, how can you contribute to that? As I did my research and was looking at where I can insert myself, I was looking more at the natural environment, which you can hear a lot about. Different terms of like nature-based solutions, how you can actually use the environment to counter or mitigate some of these risks, whether it's fire, flood, you know, hurricanes, whatever it is. And I was looking at that and I became more interested, not just in emergency management, because a lot of it focused on, as I learned through my research and interacting with people in the industry, is it's more focused on coordinating emergency services, kind of like Mike was doing in the beginning of beating up with the firefighters in the neighborhood and, you know, figuring that stuff out, you know.
I always stand ready, Matt. I'm always ready.
That's right.
Put me in, boys. Put me in.
Put me in, coach. So the focus was really on that, which is great. I mean, we need that. We absolutely need that with everything else going on. But my kind of vision of where I wanted to go and interject myself kind of in that arena, if you want to think of it in that way, is more from the conservation lens of how can we manage our lands and our resources better to mitigate all of these risks that we're seeing that are all essentially interconnected. You know, if people want to talk about climate change, whether they believe it or not, or these extreme weather events, or food insecurity, land desertification, all of these things, drought. I mean, I'm in an area where drought is, we're in Washington State and people are talking about drought. You know, I'm like, there's something wrong. We're not doing something correct. Okay. So I dug in more research in that, which is, I mean, why I'm at studying sustainable agriculture. You know, right now I'm in there in Wazoo's program right now for that graduate program. I reached out to other nonprofits that are in that sector, the Soil Health Academy, which is a great organization if anybody's interested in soil health and regenerative agriculture. I got certified in permaculture from an accredited Permaculture Institute of North America organization to kind of really dig in different perspectives on how you manage ecosystems, the environment, land stewardship. And kind of identify what is the issue and what are the solutions to fix it. And a lot of it is land management. And a lot of it comes from the food industry, which you probably hear a lot of, you know, it's the cows and the methane and, you know, all that stuff, greenhouse gases, you know, it's getting hot, which is true. A lot of it is true. And it all comes down to more of land management, how you manage your natural resources. And it's all connected through that lens, which brings me to this property here, which not only allows me to work on my own food system, my own local food system for myself and my family, and then try to also apply all the theories I learned and put it in practice. How can you actually operationalize this? Because we talk about it in that industry, if you're into it at all, regenerative agriculture and land restoration, nature-based solutions, and all that terminology. It's all about a lot of theory, a lot of talk about it, and how do you actually apply it? How can the normal, you said you have just a backyard, Scott, or in suburbia, I have 10 acres, you have large farms that are hundreds, thousands of acres as well, it doesn't matter. how you manage your land and how you manage your resources is going to have a huge impact, even in just your backyard. I'll use an example, lawns, suburban lawns. We all know it. Okay. We all have this picture perfect of, we want a golf course. We want to trim it down. I want it nice and neat. No weeds, edged, monoculture, single grass. It better be emerald green. All right. That is, even HOAs enforce this. Okay. But what is it ecologically doing to the environment? Okay. The grass can no longer hold water. So you're forced to use a sprinkler system to continue to force water onto it during the summer when it's just dehydrating the landscape. So you're paying extra money for short grass that's going to dehydrate anyways. You're causing your own doom loop there. You're forcing yourself to pay more money for something that's not working. It's a monoculture. Okay. So nature is not monoculture. Okay. It has a diversity of plants. So now you have pest infestation. You have no plants that are helping each other or helping the soil microbiology, because it's all a living system. You have no shade, so it's hotter. You're forced to work more to mow for whatever reason. Then you throw all of your grass away to go into the landfill, which then emits more methane and carbon gases into the air, which is then culminating into the main issue that we're talking about anyways with everything else going on. And that's just a very small, kind of like small community example of like what we're doing. And it doesn't make ecological sense on how you manage your land. So I apply that to my concept here on the 10 acres of, you ask like, well, how are you growing your food and what you're doing? The first step is to, at least for me, was to just pause and look at what I have in the landscape. Like I said, it's a mix of forest. Part of it got deforested recently, and then I have wetland. You have three different environments there, and each impact or action you have on the environment is going to have kind of cascading second, third order effects. An example here is the deforested area around my property, which I want to grow. When I first got here, the sand was dust. It was dust covered in, you know, weeds, which are just, you know, plants you don't want. And they're just plants. But if you understand natural succession, that's nature's first responders, is weeds. That's why it goes to the most degraded area. Weeds start popping up because it wants to start feeding carbon into the soil to feed soil microbiology, which then the microbiology can feed next succession of plants to shrubs, to trees. That's just how nature works. So I have the soil. Going back to the lawn story before, if you have weeds, you spray herbicide and pesticide everywhere, right? Well, you're killing the soil microbiology, which is costing you to cost more money to put force inputs into it, which again, doesn't make sense. So I have a soil issue. Why do I have a soil issue? Because I'm on slope terrain in the mountains and it just got deforested. I reset the entire natural succession. Or I didn't do it. That's just how it was when I got here. I'm just reaping, you know, what happened. It's just reset. So now it's dusty soil that's exposed to sun, that's cooking the soil, that's killing everything. And now the weeds are there to try to protect it. So the first step is, well, I have the issue. How do I fix this? One of our first projects we did here, and I highly recommend you start small, is first observe what you have, even throughout the whole seasons if you can, and then realize what the issue is, which mine is water management. The soil and plants can't hold the water on slope terrain, so it's washing everything away. So our first project was to establish berms on contour, and we used like old logs from our forest to establish this, to then hold or slow down water. And I think that the mantra is slow, spread, sink, and store. If you could think of that way with your water, because water is huge. If you don't have water, you don't have life. So using those berms on contour is going to slow all of the rain and water down. Because again, I'm in Northeast Washington, a ton of rain and a ton of snow. And when that bad boy melts after winter, that stuff is flying downhill and taking everything with it. So I need to slow it down. And I need to spread it out across the land, and then I need to sink it back into the soil. And that's what we did. And that was our first project about before winter that we did. And from winter and post-melt now, and I go out there, it's green, man. It is green. Like, I was surprised. I was like, holy cow. Huge difference in just ecological impact of what happened. Adding on to that, we did some cover crop before we did that as well. So the snow pushed the cover crop seed down into the ground. The berm slowed the water down, let it sink. It hydrated all the plants. And now I moved the succession forward. Nature would have done it either naturally or it would have done something else completely different. But I'm trying to guide it, or as I say, you know, steward it. I can't control it, but I can help guide it to where I want it to be using, you know, ecological principles. And now I'm getting grass. I'm getting different vegetation, which is then going to repair the soil, which then prepares it to grow food. How I'm growing food right now, it's in the ground. I have a couple of beds, and then I have a couple of raised beds that we built. We also have a greenhouse that we built as well, because summer's going to come. It's going to come hot, and it's going to leave. And then I'm going to have 6 months of winter up here. So try to extend the growing season. We have the greenhouse as well. This is primarily vegetables, and I'm going to do kudos to my wife. She's more of the horticulturalist, more of the gardener than me, better green thumb than me. Vegetables, tomatoes, lettuce, carrots, peas. We have fruits. We have a couple fruit trees out there we planted. Raspberries, blueberries, onions, a bunch of herbs. So we're incorporating a lot of companion planting, edible landscapes, ground covers, native pasture, because I think I'm trying to turn 1 to 2 acres into grassland pasture up here so I can have animal impact, which is huge. First is going to be chickens, but eventually I think we're going to go up to maybe sheep or goats as well. So we're prepping the land. So I said observation is one. Identify what the problem is and how you can solve your water management to support what you have, because I don't have sprinklers and stuff, so you need water. And then another aspect is think about is how you're going to incorporate animals into your land as well, because those are your natural workers, so you don't have to do it yourself and buy fertilizer or buy herbicides or pesticides or out there weeding by hand all the time, which I know I've been doing it for the past week. That's tough work. But animals can do it for you. They can fertilize. They can handle your vegetation for you. They can provide food for you. They're multifunctional. They belong in the ecosystem. Whether you want to eat them or not, that's on you. But they help manage the land. The land and the animals are all interconnected. You remove the animals, I mean, what's going to handle all the vegetation? Which you end up having wildfire risk, you know, over vegetation. Nothing is trimming down the hedges, or weeds are taking over, invasive species are taking over everywhere, so on and so forth. Diet, to answer your question with diet, if we go, we do buy store-bought food. Absolutely we do, because like I said, we're trying to prep the land first to grow all of our food. So, I mean, yeah, we try to stick to organic certified, even though we know that that's not the best, but in the end, organic certified is with high confidence. It doesn't have agrochemicals applied to it. It's not perfect, but it's definitely better than your average food that you buy. We eat meat, vegetables. We just try to stick to the organic type food. And then, like you said, you grow true organic, which is as naturally as possible, is what we do here on our homestead. Here's how we're trying to eat. Try to stick to as much nutrient dense food as possible, which is why we're trying to grow it as organically or as natural as possible. Because I think a little known fact is that most of the food that we grow now that are in the grocery stores are not as nutritious as they were, you know, right, decades right. ago. So we're essentially
Prior to the Industrial Revolution.
Exactly. So we essentially have an industrial food system that is pumping out a ton of food that is not as nutritious as it was before. So you went from mass production of low quality food, when I'm trying to think of, you know, small production of high quality food for myself and my family for now, by growing in this method, which is a huge issue. Because if the industrial system is part of, well, I'll bring this up. And pause me if I'm like ranting on too much. If you're like, holy
dude,
cow, man.
Go, dude. Hit record.
This is my religion right now. Yes. Yeah. It's like I said, my backyard garden is my experimentation. I learned how to expand later in life.
Mm-hmm.
So when I do get that 10, 100 acres, that 10 plus
acres. Yeah, you are.
That's the goal, is to go be not off grid, but rural. I would like to have solar and, things like that, just have less of an environmental impact, but
I can help with your energy use. Just let me know.
Right. I'd like to have like tertiary sources of heat and power and water filtration and all those things. That's eventually where I want to get to.
Mm-hmm.
So like right now you're having a conversation with me and I'm just like, yeah.
Yes, I'm with you.
Yeah, Matt, like, where do we sign up?
Exactly. Like,
you got 10 acres next door to you, man. We can be neighbors.
Yeah, absolutely. Come over, man. More the merrier. Like you said, there's the risk of being called a prepper or anything like that when you start talking about this. But it's like, I mean, I get it. Some people are. I mean, they have like crazy stuff going on. But if you're talking about like basic human needs, like I want clean air, I want clean food, I want clean water, I want clean soil. Like there's nothing crazy about that. Like that should just be normal human stuff. But it's very difficult to find that in our world now, which is, you pause and think about it, like that's insane. Like all of our municipal water has to be filtrated and treated, and it's still
chlorinated
and your soils have tons of agrochemical pesticides, herbicides in it. Mm-hmm. All this stuff you hear about, and I'm not going to rant on too long about that, but I'm just saying it's basic needs. So it's not prepper. It's self-reliance.
When you were looking at your cover crops to keep roots in the ground, and that's something that's kind of the easy way of saying it, right? Is your soil is always going to be better if there's always roots in the ground or something growing on it or something along those lines, right? When you were looking at your cover crops, did you go through like a soil testing procedure to make sure you were nitro fixing or phosphate or phosphorus or potash fixing or anything along those lines?
No, and that is something if I could go back in time, that's what I would have done. And I highly recommend people to do that to like I said before, observe and figure out what you actually have before you make big changes. And I think a soil test is huge to do that. And I absolutely recommend doing it, not just in one spot, multiple areas in your property. You should probably do that to see what you actually have going on underneath. What I did was more of a visual inspection, of doing more of a shovel test of just, simple, get a shovel, dig in there, take a scoop out. What do you have? You're like, look at the soil. What color is it? How does it feel? Where are the roots? Are they shallow? Are they long? Do you have, is there any fungi in there? These are all indicators of how your soil is doing health-wise. And I'm going to caveat when I'm saying this on this podcast, I'm not a soil scientist. I'm not a climatologist. I'm none of these things. I'm not even a farmer or a rancher. I'm a practitioner that has been on a quest for the past year or two of picking the minds of the experts in these fields and trying to operationalize them on my own property, and then potentially business aspirations later on. So I'm going to caveat that with that.
Have you you just mentioned a business aspect of it? And I want to comment on two things that you just said. The business aspect of it is, are you familiar with Comfort Farms out of the Southeast? I don't know if he's actually in Georgia or if he's on the Alabama side of the Chattahoochee. I don't remember what state he's actually located in. He was a 375 guy. When he retired or exited, he opened up Comfort Farms, where he is building sustainable farming and ranching practices and things along those lines. Named after Lieutenant Kyle Comfort, who was killed in action in 375, I believe. He was also a lieutenant in the 101st Airborne, who was a friend of mine's PL at one point, but not the same. The guy who owns the farm named his farm after that. Might be a good person to reach out to, just use that 75th connection and say, hey, I'm trying to do something that you are already doing. I would love to get some insight on that.
Oh, I appreciate that. Absolutely. I never heard of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll send you a link for that.
Please do.
Yeah. And I'll see if I have a connection there. At one point I knew a guy, I don't know if he's still around there or not, but I'll see if I can make that connection. And then secondly, I think it's important to understand that you don't have to be an agro-scientist. You don't have to be a soil, you know, some weird, you know, I'm going to say weird. Yeah, it's probably not a fair statement to make, but you don't have to be a scientist to want to grow your own food and just learn things. Like mm-hmm. you don't have to go to school to be a student. You know, you don't have to do those things. It's really important for people to understand that you can do those things without the credentialing, without the, you know, whatever, because this information exists. It's just all out there that you can learn on your own. And oh, by the way, like my great grandfather wasn't a scientist either. He was just, you know, some dude in West Virginia that didn't want to work in the coal mines.
You know? Absolutely.
And that's, I think that's important. I think that's one of the most important points that you've made. Is that you don't have to be that person in order just to do the thing that is right for you or feels right for you or mm-hmm. something along those lines. I'll get your phone number or your email address from Mike. And also there's some really good books out there, like The Art of Fermentation is a really great book for food preservation. Mm-hmm. So it's not like brewing beer when we talk about fermentation. Fermentation is the oldest method of preservation known to man. Next, like smoking, salting, fermentation. It's all kind of along those same lines. And you know, when you're looking at those crops lasting you know, through that 6 months of winter, and you know how to can your tomatoes, or you know how to do these things for preservation over the winter. There's a lot of just great resources that just exist out there that are hundreds of years old. Mm-hmm. And again, you don't have to be a scientist to know how to do a 2% salt solution against the mass of which you're trying to ferment and preserve. It's not hard. You need a scale. That's the most scientific thing that you need. And maybe some hot water to sterilize the dog.
Great point.
Yeah. I'm extremely impressed by everything you just said. It makes me feel a little bit better that I'm not just some weird kooky person out here, you know, thinking of these things on my own. But also just to hear you say these things, it's like, I also too wonder, my friend Patrick, who is a high school friend of mine, whom I love and cherish to this day. I appreciate our friendship. He said that the two people that can really identify kind of what's wrong with government and the way it works are veterans and convicts. And because you have an intimate thing. So I wonder if like the veteran experience that you had to kind of led you to kind of look at, you know, how many MREs did you have to eat before you were like, man, I really wish I was growing my own food right now.
Sure.
You know, and that sort of thing. So sorry, it kind of went off. I just really wanted to, I am overwhelmed with like gratitude for just this conversation.
No, I appreciate that. And I appreciate your journey on going to, I think it resonates with a lot of people I talk to are like, you know what? I'm thinking the same thing. Mm-hmm. I want to do it, but they hold themselves back. And that goes with any career transition, anybody. Like, I'm going to hold myself back because of X, Y, Z. I don't have academia, or I don't have this profession, or his, like, you know, when it comes to the basic human needs, you just need to just do it. Like, don't be afraid. Or if another career transition, or you want to, the knowledge is out there. Go do it. And if you're too scared to do it or anything like that, you know, I always go back to what I was told a long time ago, and you know, in regimen is, you know, sometimes you just have to RTFU. You guys heard of that, Mike?
Oh yeah, buddy.
Yeah, you just have to do it, man.
Sometimes you just got to range the fuck up.
That's whoa, right. Whoa,
there it is. Sorry, boys. Sorry.
Explicit content at the end.
Sometimes we go that way.
It's okay. There was, for our one listener who was like, what? Another acronym, right. PACE plan, RTFU, damn it. And that, there you go. I just spelled it out for you.
When in doubt, look it up on YouTube.
There you go.
YouTube University.
Well,
that's actually how I learned how to grow organic vegetables.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's how I fixed a door handle on a 2013 Mercedes C300. Literally yesterday.
Bam. There it is.
Continue.
Dude, Matt, killer conversation, man. I really appreciate you coming on, telling us a little bit about your story, a little bit about your journey. Obviously, the journey's ongoing, man. It's ongoing. Like, you ain't, we're not there yet. So I want to check back in at some point.
This is Matt Thomas, episode one, I think.
That's right? It. Absolutely. Please do. This journey's gone.
Yeah.
Call in from the phone only.
Yeah, exactly. We homestead in the computer. Hate. We don't have to do that. Or we could get the one of them kiddos. Maybe they want to go into computer science from the homestead. They build you something.
Cool. I don't recommend it.
I hope. Let's see, because I'm not there. I'm not there,
yeah,
fellas. Right?
Yeah.
I appreciate you guys putting me on here.
Yeah, right on. Enjoy
talking to you. Great conversation, guys.
Yeah, killer, dude. Totally appreciate it.
All right. Well, let's check our show notes right quick, and then we will wrap this baby.
Oh.
Mike is a neighborhood first responder.
Yes.
Matt's childhood overseas and his path to the Army. Tech challenges lead into more on Matt's transition to life after retirement. Matt's input and responsibilities to command as his retirement process began and evolved. Matt's plan with his family after retirement and into land stewardship. Building the family after retirement and the soil and food plan on Matt's homestead. That's what I got so far.
Killer.
Over.
That was a good one, guys. Thank you, Matt, for the time this morning.